Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. On this podcast, we feature a session from the EDUCAUSE 2012 annual conference. Our presentation is entitled Academic Completion in a Lifelong Learning Universe. What's that? And our speaker is Peter Smith, Senior Vice President for Academic Strategies and Development at Kaplan University Corporate Office.
Thank you very much, and I thought I had that other story squashed. But anyway, I'm delighted to be here, and I'm going to talk for maybe 30 or 35 minutes, and then hopefully I will have laid out enough whatever we might think that will grow a few seeds of questions, and we'll engage in more of a conversation. I appreciate a short and a sweet introduction because one of the things that she did not mention is that I am a recovering politician and served briefly in the United States Congress. Living proof you don't need term limits. After I left the Congress, which is what you say when you lose, it's a little bit like attending your own wake. Because you're still elected for the next two or three months, people still have leaky roofs, you're still going around talking, and it's a pretty uncomfortable and bizarre moment in your own life. And I was in Middlebury, Vermont, at a Rotary Club, and I think people who live on campuses or around campuses certainly might understand what it's like to be in a small state or a small town where you might know somebody all your life, and they really don't like you, and you really don't like them. I know that never happens in colleges and universities. They are just vessels of comity. That's with a T. So I'm at Middlebury, say the Rotary Club. I'm from Burlington, and the fellows, the president of the Rotary Club, is going to introduce me as one of those people in my life. We were in elementary school together. He'd never worked for me, never voted for me, never supported me. I mean, he was thrilled that I had lost. So when he introduced me, he pulled out my resume that I'd sent, of course, and he read it word for word. Luckily, I sent him the short one, so it only took about 10 minutes. And then he said, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Congressman Peter Smith, a man with a great future behind him. So I love them when they're short and sweet, and I thank you for that. The challenge of IT, and what I'm going to talk about, is I call it the challenge to the existing status quo. And my particular focus today is going to be on the whole notion of what it means to be a completer, or what the completion agenda ought to look like, is similar in many ways, a little different, but similar to what it means to start a university from scratch, which I had the pleasure of doing with my colleagues, John Idelson and Bobby Camille and others at Cal State Monterey Bay, and much earlier in my just post-adolescent phase, I was lucky enough to be able to found a community college in Vermont. But at Cal State Monterey Bay, we were surrounded by this old Army base. We had no technology. We had nothing. And we had 7 months to stand it up because the students were coming because all the smart people had decided we needed to start real fast. And we were all in this room, first day, and I told this story because I think it bears telling again today because I think it is the kind of situation we face. During a political campaign, I had a lot of two-lane roads in Vermont, and I was behind, I had this college student driving me, and I'm going over to IBM to do these absolutely ridiculous things you do in politics, which is have a sign and stand there and wave at people as they leave work. It's like, that's why they're leaving work, so they can catch a glimpse of you on the corner. Anyway, we're behind this huge truck, and it is going very slowly. And we get to a little hill, and the guy would stop, and he'd get out, and he'd take a bat, and he'd hit the side of the truck, and then he'd jump in the truck, and he'd drive up the hill, and we'd go along for a while. And I'm going crazy because I got to get to IBM and wave my signs. And we're going about 45 miles an hour with all these stops because there's a lot of hills in Vermont. So at one of the last hills, I jumped out of the car because I couldn't stand it any longer. And here's this guy, like this with a bat. And he's just an old Vermonter. He's got a hat on and he's working. And the side of the truck looks like somebody's been hitting it with a bat quite a bit. And I said, "Excuse me, sir. I'm Peter Smith. I'm running for lieutenant governor. Can you tell me what you're doing?" He said, "Sure." He says, "It's an old rig, as you can see." And it was a dreadfully old rig. He says, "I got about 300 chickens in here." And he says, "It don't pull so good anymore. So when I get to a hill, I jump out, take the bat, I hit the side of the truck. The chickens fly up in the air. I jump back in the truck and drive up the hill before the chickens land. And that's how I get up the hill." Forget the physics of this for a minute, okay? I just wanted you to know that I knew. So what we agreed that day in Monterey was our job is to make the chickens fly, that we have to somehow suspend lots of our thinking that has driven us to, in that case, a very progressive views of education, but this was going to be a whole new deal, and we just had to think very different, and we called it making the chickens fly. And the metaphor got us through a couple of years where we hadn't made the chickens fly, something bad would have happened. So what is the single most important thing about IT today, in my estimation? And by that I mean telescoping out to an understanding of social networking, the cloud, and the web. The most, to me, important component as it relates to colleges and universities and teaching and learning, or the learning enterprise, is that we in the academy, whoever we are, do not control either the source, the current state, or the future of where this technology and potential is going to take us. There has not been a change in higher education that I am aware of in the history of higher education when the academy has not been responsible for driving the change and hence controlling it, bending it to their will, and that could be different from type of institution to type of institution. The reason I think this is the most important aspect of what this early stage epoch of this epoch that we are entering, the reason this is important is because for the first time, we only control our destiny to the extent that we decide to deal dramatically, productively, and usefully with the potentials that are brought by this extraordinary array of resources and opportunities. And to me, for those who say, well, it'll fit in a little or we'll do a little blended over here, there aren't very many institutions in my mind that can afford to ignore or to not engage with what is going on off their campuses and needs to be going on their campuses. I finished a book a couple of years ago called Harnessing America's Wasted Talent, A New Ecology of Learning. And in it, we talked about what I called C21 Cs, which is colleges for the 21st century. And my point there was that, you know, the educational, the learning proposition overall, the value proposition and the elements of that value proposition don't change very much. I mean, but what will change and is changing dramatically is how they are bundled. And so I go from unbundling to rebundling. So if you think about this, what I believe we are seeing and will see, and I'll use some examples as I get into my remarks a little deeper, is that the traditional notion of place, people, resources, economics, we know it well. There are alternatives to it, but it is far and away the dominant model in the world, because in my time in UNESCO, it became very clear that every place where people were looking to create, they were looking at our model as it existed in 1975. I mean, and so that's where the modeling is taking place. So this is not just an American phenomenon. It is all over the world. But the notion that you can unbundle those parts of the value proposition of higher education, or I would argue K-12 as well, and then we will see in a C21C will be described or by characteristics, not by form. Now, I was arguing 2.5 years ago that we'll see a wide variety of forms of service delivery that will be rebundles of different elements of the overall value proposition that has been understood in its dominant form as higher education. And so if you think about MOOCs, which nobody had really anticipated, why would they? We had open education resources, but we hadn't taken the next or had somebody else take the next step, where an unthought-of thing, where somebody would offer a course for 100 plus thousand people or 5,000 people, doesn't matter, for free, and it would become adopted by the most prestigious institutions in the country, thus removing one of the most difficult elements or steps in innovation, which is the minute the top 100 institutions are engaged in this behavior, the need for anybody else to explain why it is worth doing, to legitimize, and all innovation needs to be legitimized. It needs to be explained. It needs to be proven. But in this case, with MITx and, excuse me, and EDX and Coursera and all the others, you see people immediately embracing something from which we will learn, and it isn't all going to work exactly right. It already isn't all working exactly right. But the nature of the debate, because of who brought the MOOCs and how they were brought and what the curriculum was, the nature of the discussion changed overnight, starting last December when MIT announced what it was going to do with MITx. And so, to me, it is one of the elements that most of us will have to deal with is that there will be great content, it will be commoditized, and it will be low cost or no cost. And for those of us who think that people are coming to our institutions, and I'm thinking of the 5,000 plus now institutions, not the 200 or so, because we have great faculty, do we really think that if the physics chair at a rural state college in any state in America had done a MOOC, do we really think 150,000 people would have signed up? Maybe, but I don't think so. I don't think so. For the same reasons that iTunes University, with all of its breadth and depth and millions of users, we know it's there, we know it gets used, but it hasn't been on the front page of the newspaper at least once a week for a year. But this is. So you see, the conversation has changed. And the reality within the MOOC world, in my mind, or because of MOOCs, is that the role of content has changed really forever. Now, how much and where that ball stops rolling for the time being, I don't know about that. We know that we can get far more reliable, consistent, and valid assessments. And consistent is the word that matters here, because we have operated in an academic world in which a certificate or a degree was an academic recognition of completion of academic courses. Over the last 45 or 50 years, those degrees and certificates have become proxies for being ready to work. But we all know, if we believe what we read or our own experience in my case, that you can be ready to graduate from a very prestigious university and not ready to work in the job that you are given or accept after you leave the university. And I would tell you that I think we are going to see increasing requirements and, well, I hope not requirements, but requests for proof that people know what it is you say they know and a connection between what they know and how it ties them to an occupational area or a job. So that the proxy value of the degree or the certificate, I think, with the rise of badges and what lies beyond badges, which I can't quite characterize yet, but the proxy value of that, I think, is going to decline, and we're going to see the rise of other kinds of recognition of learning that tie it much more directly to either the social, the civic, the economic, or the personal agenda of the learner. And so if it's economic, it's going to be work. If it's social or personal, it's going to be something else. And I think we're going to see much, much more of that. And no matter what, we're going to see a reduced time to degree where institutions acknowledge that learning can happen someplace else, and those that don't will either survive or not. But I think you're going to see far more transparency, and we're going to see the cost of degrees go down, because an annual tuition is based on the notion of an agricultural calendar where you go to school and spend 9 months and come back. What about talking about the tuition as being what you're going to pay to get your degree? That's a very different question, and I think people are going to begin to think that way. So when you think about a C21C, and I've used those four examples, and I'll put the fourth in, big data, we are able now not only to reduce the time to degree, to reduce the cost of the degree, to have far better assessments of learning, to access phenomenal content and work around it and with it, thus asking the mentor or the faculty member to really be an educator as opposed to someone who stands and delivers in front of a class or in front of a larger group. We have all those potentials, and I think with it, big data, as it is now currently called, for the time being anyway, is a huge opportunity. We have the ability to know more about how people are doing week by week and class by class in blended and online curriculum, to look for anomalies that may across sections of the same course, where there may be in one case a problem with the structure of the curriculum, there may be another case faculty training, another case something going on in the learner's life and they're not engaging. We can do that day by day and week by week and section by section and course by course. We do it at Kaplan University, and it is astonishing how quickly you can get into the teaching learning environment and try to fix something and then measure whether the fix works. So I think, and that's just touching the tip of the iceberg, I think it's going to be a huge, huge change. So for me, a C21C, and we're thinking about a lifetime of learning, isn't going to be in a form. It's going to be about outcomes, one way or the other. It's going to be about personalization. It's going to be about customization. It's going to be about transparency to the workplace, and it's going to be about transparency to the degree. There are going to be some other things in it, but what's going to happen is that people are going to bundle according, I think ultimately learners will start bundling what they want and when they want it to get where they want to go with help, and I think institutions are going to have to make some of the same accommodations. So if you take all of this and what it implies to me anyway, I think the meaning of completion has changed already and will change more from the attainment of a certificate or the attainment of a degree. If you think about it, we have the things that I've just described. We've talked about IT and the web as a point of access, and that was the earliest value that people saw. I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember Sunrise Semester, but I'm embarrassed to say I am. Then we know that we can get rich and cheap assessments in front of learners immediately that help them think about their learning style, to think about occupations or professions they might want to go into, think about what they already know, think about how to learn better online or in a blended environment. There are all these things we can do that we could never have done before we had the beginning of this IT revolution. We also have the ability, and learners have the ability, to archive their learning. And I used to talk about archiving and curating, and people thought I was crazy. I wasn't the only person doing it. I'm not saying that. But today you hear a lot more about these wonderful words that actually mean something in other worlds. But if I am able to archive and keep track of and organize the learning I've done, whether it's in the United States Army or the Labor Union Hall or the corporate training site or in college and university or in my own personal life, if I can collect it and understand it better and keep it current and bring it to an employment, social, civic, personal challenge that is facing me, that is a dramatic difference from what I was able to do even 10 years ago in terms of the quickness. It's sort of the long tail of personal learning, all the learning you do. It's there, and it can be recalled immediately for good use in academic or work or other environments. And then we get to where I think, along with assessment, much of the future lies, which is the curation of the learning. In other words, how do you organize it? How do you understand it? It isn't just storing it, it's using it, it's reflecting on it. I believe that the deepest learning happens when you reflect with a person who knows a lot about the subject that you're reflecting on. Reflection is the process by which you extract meaning from experience. So the experience was the course in a traditional, but the reflection is on what it is you learned, how you changed, what it meant to you, what you're going to do with it. That is the value that I believe only people can bring to teaching and learning. And one of the really exciting things is if you think about assessment and reflection, assessment of all forms and reflection, those are things, they are deeply educational. They change learners' lives. And I would argue, not that the people in this room necessarily, but in general, they are the least available commodity in most college campuses. We're busy testing and grading and performing and showing up and going away and finishing, as opposed to pondering the meaning of it all. And I believe that in the C21C, but in this changing meaning of completion that we are going to see, the ability, the opportunity to really spend time on what matters. Because we've got the content, we've got the learning plan, we've got all the things that are almost never available in a consistent way. And now we've got the time to do what only people can do, which is think about what has happened to them and what they want to do next. To me, that is an enormous opportunity. The mass customization and the personalization that can happen because of what we're doing is remarkable. So let me talk about three or four applications of this change in completion. And what I'm talking about is there is no end point to learning, whether you have a certificate or a degree or you don't. That you are always learning. Research tells us that. We know it. Much of it is tacit. Much of it we forget we know, but it's in there working. And so how do you structure policy? How do you structure programs for the vast majority of the population over the age of 25, let's say, who simply are going to continue to learn, are going to do so much more explicitly, and they're going to want to do something with their learning? And how are we going to help them? So I think it has major implications for the workplace. If the workplace can become a place of learning, explicitly a place of learning, and the boundaries go down between the university or the college on the one hand and the workplace on the other, then, in fact, you have the ability to work and learn, convert that learning to academic value, do some of that learning, take it back to the workplace. You have a conversation, if you will, going on between two sites where historically, despite our best efforts, there has been a barrier. And it is a barrier that is expensive, and it is expensive to the country, it's expensive to students, and it is expensive to workers. The only people it's not expensive for, so far, are the institutions that insist on the barriers, because then you pay them more money. But those days are going to come to an end for most institutions, I believe. So huge implications for the workplace and for the campuses. Huge implications for accreditation. If we, in fact, are interested in the quality of learning that goes on, but we are not as interested in measuring certificates and degrees per se, and there are other ways of looking at the institution helping people get what they came for and getting it in a good qualitative way at a better price, let's say, that would be nice. I think how we rate learning is going to change. How we rate institutional effectiveness and quality is going to change. think the same is true of financial aid, and I will use that as one of my closing examples. I think the same is true of the academic calendar. I know it's a great way to organize the year, and I have to admit, when I was president of Cal State Monterey Bay, I didn't mind getting even 3 weeks in a row off in the middle of the summer to go and, you know, put my feet up. But I think those days are on the verge of, are beginning to be over. There is no excuse for a calendar, ultimately, that doesn't allow a student to begin almost any time. American Public University starts students every week now, and they are doing very well. So we're going to have to rethink what the calendar means and how we organize our human professional resources. I think huge implications on this as this completion agenda changes. And all of those things taken together add up to the economic model that organizes campuses, people, physical resources, place, IT investments. How does that economic model have to change in order to serve students who are going to be looking increasingly for some form of the C21C, the College for the 21st Century? Now, I'm going to use Pell Grants as one example. I confessed I'm a recovering politician, and I got the great honor of serving on education committees in the Vermont State Senate and in the United States Congress. And I actually thought it was an honor to be on the Education Committee, unlike the vast majority of my colleagues. So I got a chance, this is a long time ago, to wrestle with some of these questions, and then I did chair a national panel on reforming financial aid in the early 90s. I actually hired Jamie Marisotis, draw your own conclusions about who's made their way better over the ensuing 23 years. I learned a lot about financial aid over 20 years ago. What would happen if the Pell Grant became a drawing account? It had a certain amount of money in it, and every time you went to take a course or two or whatever, you would register, and if you had your taxes, your income, and you qualified, you'd get the money. You get the money for what you needed it for. You didn't have to enroll in a degree plan. You didn't have to enroll in a certificate. But you came and you had to have a plan. I want to take three courses and do this. I want to take two courses and do that. And the money was there if you were eligible, and you'd simply reapply, and your balance would go down until you had taken either 40 courses or whatever the number would be, or you ran out of money. I believe that something like when we get into reauthorization, I'm not saying it's going to happen today or tomorrow, but we are going to have to unbundle the way we support learners in their learning who need and deserve support so that our financial assistance supports the pattern of their lives. And right now, our financial assistance not only does not support the pattern of their lives and what their needs are, it bears very little relationship to what they are able to sustain. But we continue to do it because we in the institutions get the money, and we have a pattern that they have to fit into, and the results simply across all sectors are not what we would want them to be. They just are not. So imagine that you could modularize or break the curriculum at any one of the institutions represented in this room. You could break it down to courses. You can. There they are. They're in the catalog. People can take any one they want. And the next step is that what would happen if people decided to take all these MOOCs and use other free resources and accumulate a whole bunch of learning in their archive, and then they want to organize it, and then they're going to come and ask you to make sense out of it, to evaluate it, and to tell them how much more they have to learn via your process. And we have competency or outcomes places like Western Governors or Thomas Edison or Charter Oaks or Excelsior, or we can do it credit-based the way most of us do it. But the notion that we then place them, for which they pay something, and then they know exactly how much more they have to do successfully to get a degree and it happens at the point in time when they want to do it, not at the point in time when we say they should do it. So they then know exactly what it's going to cost them to get to their goal. And again, if you have financial aid, you have the Pell Grant or state grants or loans, if they go that far, there to support them. They know what is the journey they're on. They know how long it's going to take if they are successful. It is not the unknown of signing up for a degree program you, in many cases, haven't thought about, paying money and taking loans about which the consequences of you haven't thought about, and then for way too many people, someplace in the first 2 years saying, this just isn't for me, and walking away with failure and debt and disappointment. So for me, embracing a new understanding of completion, personalizing it, and allowing our financial aid programs to mirror it is one very good example of how, if we were to begin to think about lifelong learning as a change in our understanding of completion. And you could accumulate for certificates, you can accumulate for degrees, you're not out of the business, you're just meeting your own needs first. My observation over, God forbid, more than 40 years is that most adults return to school for a reason, that something's happened in their lives. It's usually not positive. And we make them do all these things that we think they should do in order for them to get to what they came for. And I think what happens with this incredible IT revolution, the whole thing gets in potential. Gets turned upside down. I have been characterized from time to time many ways, one of which is occasionally wrong, but never in doubt. And I want to assure you that I'm speaking the way I'm speaking because I want to be clear about what I think the opportunities and the potentials are. I also believe in the things that I've said, but I don't for a minute hold out that I have any better idea than anybody else about what we're going to be talking about next year. My bet is it's going to be about some of the things that I'm talking about today, because the reference is still teaching and learning on the campus. That is, there's all sorts of other things going on here, but the reference is about campus-centric issues. There are three times as many people and three times as much money involved in employment-based education at the post-secondary level than there are in campus-based education. There are millions of more people out there, and now we have the ability to serve them in meaningful, focused ways throughout their lives if we're smart enough and eager enough to figure out how to capture that learning and how to assess it, archive it, and make it ready through curation for the consumption of employers or of educational institutions. I don't know if anybody's got any questions, but I said I'd leave 15 minutes, and I'm down to about 13, and I'm happy to take a question. Please come to a microphone or speak very loudly, and I will repeat the question. Sir.
I wanted to pick on a point you made about the academic calendar should not be limiting when students can start taking classes. So what you're implying, if I'm reading between the lines here correctly, is the concept of possibly self-paced, self-starting education. Now, I work for a business college, you know, undergrad, business degrees, MBAs. When you think in terms of an MBA, a lot of the value perceived academically is in group work. Now, if you've got people starting throughout the academic year.
Could you move that up a little bit? Just
If you got people starting throughout the academic year, and you get people on their own timeline, possibly even self-paced, how do you ensure the value of the group work, the dialogue, the discussion, when you started 3 weeks ago, I started now, somebody else is starting 2 weeks from now, as far as getting that continuum where we're all on the same page? Because what you're talking about almost is a correspondence course, unless you can get some sense of collaboration amongst your peers.
You're on a campus?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm asking in terms of online.
You know, I'll tell you a story that I know to be true from our experience. We had a course in ethnicity and race relations online, and most of our courses, there are between 15 and 18 people and a teacher. and they involve instruction, and then they involve conversation, and then they involve group work through, well, since I'm not real literate in the terms here, like chat rooms that are for those people. And the three women working with a faculty member on a project towards the end of this course. And one of them said, I'm really having a hard time with this, typing it in, because I don't know any African-Americans, and I don't have any African-American friends. And one of the other ones said, yes, you do. I'm African-American. What's on your mind? Now, that doesn't go directly to your question, but what I want to say is to look at Open Study and what they're doing with the Global Open Courseware Consortium. Over 50,000 people are in conversation groups. They aren't all in the same place, but that doesn't mean they can't have a conversation. Somebody who's farther ahead can answer a question of somebody who's in their second week. And there is the notion that we can't have community in an online environment, I think, is is not a complete a complete notion. I know there are cases where that has not worked, but I also know in this research to show that people are stereotyped visually in classrooms. That there are people who sit in the back, people who sit in the front. The numbers are usually, because of the economics, more than 15. And if you're fat or you're, you know, of color or whatever, it can have a dramatic impact. So I think the deal is, to me, how do you organize the calendar? You have to figure it out. You want to do it once a month? You want to do it once a week? Do you require you have more than five people? Your cost structure changes because you've got a lot of stuff online. You may be able to blend 3 weeks worth of groups into one learning group. But I would say that the key thing, which is very hard to do, and one of the reasons when I came back from UNESCO, I went to Kaplan because I'd spent my whole life at the Community College of Vermont, George Washington University, and then Cal State Monterey Bay, my whole educational life. And I wanted to see if what was different about the online world and whether it had value. And I've been, I don't for a minute say that we got it right and that we've done everything right. I don't think any of us have done everything right. But the potential for organizing the schedule largely around the learner's life and being able to take a course and download it because it was at 7 o'clock at night. I was going to be online, but my kid got sick, and I had to go to the hospital. So what do I do now other than miss the course? Well, you can bank it and come back the next night and take it. I think there's a lot there, but the only way to do it and to learn what works for you is to come up with a plan, make it as cautious as it needs to be to not get you fired, and see what you learn by doing it. And that is really hard to do in traditional organizational structures, not just higher ed, any organizational structure. Thinking outside of the core culture is enormously difficult to do. I hope that's a little help.
Yep.
Oh, here comes trouble.
You may wonder why Peter shook his head. This is John Idelson, a faculty member at California State University, Monterey Bay, and Peter was the founding president when I was there. Dr. Smith, you've talked about great changes here. Want to ask a question about the timing or the credit unit or credit hour. A lot of the things that you've talked about change from how much seat time we have to how much learning. And, you know, it takes, what, an hour to bake a potato in an oven, but when you put it into a microwave, you get a good baked potato in 7 minutes. But we haven't been able to break away from the credit hour and unit for how we assign faculty time, how we give credit. When are we going to really find some way of measuring units of learning, which I think is what you're sort of applying that we're going to be able to do?
Well, thank you, John. I actually could have devoted half of my remarks today to that because it's as emblematic of the changes that we need to come up with. I'm not here to describe Western governors versus somebody, Rio Salado versus some community college versus some other. There are a lot of ways to get to learning outcomes. But what I'm working on right now is I'm going to call it competency-based. I don't think that's the right term, quite frankly, but I don't have a better word, and that's where I began to use this curation idea What we want to do is assemble a portrait of the person in terms of what they know and are able to do, how they behave, what works for them, what doesn't work for them. And have that, then compare it to a curriculum, and there are ways to do this, and say, when you, in fact, have completed your 120 credits, and you've done so successfully, here is the portrait of what you know, what you're able to do, and how that works for you, either academically or in an employment environment. And so that what we are focusing on is the learning rather than the hours. Now, so whatever we call it, I think that is coming. And I think the great potential for it lies not only on the learner and other people in the learner's life, including the employer, knowing more accurately what somebody knows and is able to do, what wires them up, who do they see in the mirror every morning when they shave, if they're a guy, or brush their teeth. That would be a better way to say it. So thinking about a portrait. Now, the reason it's better for learners is because we routinely, whether we're in a remedial cycle or we are in a regular course cycle, we routinely ask people to have experiences in which they may already know half or more of the material. But you can't get a half credit for a course the way we're organized, so you have to take the whole course over again. If, in fact, we are able to deduce when somebody comes to us where they are on their journey towards whatever their objective is, and then organize learning to help them complete their journey, that is a very different thing than being able to say, look, I know you took Accounting 101 at San Diego State, but you're at Cal State Monterey Bay now, and our 101 is better than their 101, so you're going to take it again. It happens all the time. We're getting a little better, but it happens all the time, and I think it's an enormous disservice to learners. Interestingly enough, when I was second year at CSUMB, I heard that Fresno State was shorting our students. A couple went over there. I called the president, John Welty, who's a great guy. He's still there, which is a remarkable testimony to him and his leadership. I said, John, I understand you're shorting our students. You know, I resemble that. You know, I don't like that. And he laughed and he said, yeah, we are. And not much I can do about it. He said, by the way, I'm going to send you something. And he sent me an email and showed seven of their students that had transferred to Cal State Monterey Bay, and we had done exactly the same thing to them. So I was well instructed by it. But I think if we can, I think one of the reasons people leave college, and older students especially, is because what we're asking them, the curriculum we're asking them to do, does not align with the here, who I am, where I came from, what I know, why I'm here, what do I want out of this thing anyway? The two don't add up. And after a while, people, if it isn't working out, they say, the heck with it, and they walk away. A much clearer example of this is most remediation. So I flunked Algebra 1. I'm just using that because I did. And what it was the... the quadratic equation. When I go back for summer school to take Algebra 1, I have to take the whole course. They don't know what I don't know. They know I failed the course. So I go, yep, get to the quadratic equation, fail the summer course. That's the way we do it, as opposed to focusing on what's not working, whether it's in the student's life or in the curriculum or in the teaching or in the learning. Rather than differentiating that, we just throw the whole package at them again. Very expensive, and you know what? You know the remedial numbers, successful remediation? They're extraordinarily bad. It's like less than 15% actually go on to graduation if they were remediated. I think it's less than 10. But there's not a number in there that doesn't make any of us as educators proud. And the thing that's outrageous about it now, and a small O, we know how to do something about it. We know how to get inside the problem and figure out what they don't know. And so it's like when James Taylor, I'm going to close. This is it because you guys want to go get a rest from all this. James Taylor is circulated, he's selling a whole bunch of CDs, I'm going to call them. They're more interactive than that, where you can learn how to play the guitar like James Taylor. Now, think about it. So if James Taylor comes to your house, I've always wanted to sing like James Taylor, not possible, and play the guitar like James Taylor. So he comes to my house, and I say, will you teach me how to play the guitar? Well, one, he's not going to come to my house. Two, he's not going to teach me how to play the guitar because that takes a long time, and he's going to get really bored hearing me not know how to key a chord. Right? But if I get this thing, I can play the guitar along, and if I hit something I can't do, I can practice it 1,000 times until I know how to do it, and then I can go on. So what you've got in our schools is the pressure of time, all the things are, if you get in trouble, you get riffled out of the deck, as opposed to having an environment where you can practice again and again and get help again and again if you need it on exactly what it is that's tripping you up. To me, that is the potential. It's why, if you think about it, as we start succeeding with more and more people, in fact, the notion of changing what it means to complete an education will stretch out throughout life and take on vastly, I believe, different meanings. You have been patient beyond belief, and I thank you for getting up early to come and listen to an old man's ravings, and I hope you have a great day and a great rest of the conference. Thanks a lot.